Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a freshly brewed swirl of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we take on the topics others try to avoid through an exploration of legacy, fear and passing, politics, walking and black identity in the British countryside from before Britain ever began, and if that's not enough, we seek to define what jazz is in conversation with two towering saxophonists who really should know. If you want to delve deeper into our show archive, check out links to artists and performances, or have an idea for a future programme, you can find all of that at our blog, thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. And so we start with death. More specifically, Outer Circle Arts' The Death Show, which takes on our perceptions, misunderstandings and anxieties about this shared certainty. I caught up with creators and performers Antonia Beck and Lucy Nichols to help get a grip on this dialogue of the uncomfortable and darkly comic take on thanatophobia before their recent performance at Birmingham's Rep. So I'm with Antonia and Lucy, and we're going to start with an ending, I think, is probably the best way to look at it. We're talking about the Death Show, okay? Now, folks listening will think, oh, well, that's a solemn and fearful subject in some ways, but that's kind of the point, isn't it? It's kind of looking at dying, death, and the end of our lives. So let's start with defining what the Death Show is.
Well, the Death Show is a very playful look at death. It came about because we both suffer or live with death anxiety, mm-hmm. and we wanted to better understand why it is we have this anxiety. So we've been on quite an extensive research journey to find out more about the world, the sector, the industry around death, and it's helped us figure out a few things. And if anything, yes, it's made us realise that, you know, one of the big issues is that it's not a subject matter that we talk about. People don't feel comfortable talking about it, and so as a result, it's only something that we tend to experience when that moment comes. That's when those conversations start, and actually that's too late, really, for those conversations.
So that's quite a way, isn't it, to approach an anxiety or a fear, to sort of drag it onto the stage.
Yeah. You know,
that's quite a brave thing.
Well, it's an autobiographical piece, essentially. And it's all kind of very, very loosely based on real life experiences. So as Antonia said, we went on this journey, we met lots of different characters, lots of different people, had quite, at some points, quite profound experiences. And then, yeah, I've sort of made that into a show because that's our background in theatre, and that felt like quite a natural expression for us, to a way of summarising that experience and sharing it with people that didn't feel that unusual for us. And what we've created, I think, actually, is probably not what you might expect from the title.
There's something here about not just sort of reflecting on how we think about death, but there's something about trying to make it perhaps more accessible in terms of how people plan for it, not just their own death, but the death of loved ones and family.
Absolutely. I mean, we have been so fortunate in the things that we've seen and the people we've spoken to, and that's another reason for actually wanting to make a show, is because we want to share this with other people. And even if this show sparks a very small conversation for an audience member, and then that informs their plans for end of life, it feels like that's a very positive thing.
As a society, we're very quite embarrassed about that. It's quite awkward, it's uncomfortable. There's a real sort of taboo around death that's not particularly constructive to people feeling better about it. So when the time does come, and it inevitably does for all of us, it's very useful for loved ones that we've made some preparations for that.
Now, it's on that list, I think, with sort of sex and politics, of things that you don't or shouldn't talk about in polite company. There's a great Spike Milligan quote, I think, where he says, "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens."
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You've come across that.
Yeah.
So how, I guess, a lot of humour is quite dark in some ways, and is based on sort of failings or insecurities. But, and you mentioned you've gone around and talked to a number of different characters. How do you tease out the kind of comedic
aspect of that. I mean, that's quite difficult, isn't it, I guess?
No, not really.
And that's what's been so remarkable, really, is that, you know, we've been exploring this, you know, what is perceived to be quite a dark and difficult subject matter, but there is so much life within it, so much humour, and I mean, it's really been quite a roller coaster of emotion. So naturally, you know, there have been difficult experiences, some that were quite sad and upsetting, but within that, as Lucy was saying, the characters we've met, the experiences we've had, I think part of the reason is, you know, death, because death is such a universal thing, everyone does have a slightly different approach, and that's what's made for some, you know, really rich material for us to work with.
Yeah, we didn't have a difficulty with the show of thinking how to fill it. The difficulty was what to cut.
Yeah,
I mean, we've got so much material and had so many experiences that actually... it's been very easy to translate into theatre. It's just been an issue of what to leave out.
Mm. Well, I guess a good place to be, isn't it? I guess that to have a sort of glut of material.
Yes.
So, I mean, a lot of death is, I guess, wrapped up in custom and culture and religion, and to an extent, ethnicity. So, how in this show have you handled that? How do you sort of cut across those things? Because, I mean, death is a universal thing, isn't it? You know, as well as tax, it's a certainty, isn't it? You know, it's that.
Yes, and we do touch on that a little bit in the show, but we obviously, because as Lucy was saying, the show is semi-autobiographical, we were coming predominantly from our own experiences. So we're both atheists, we don't believe in religion, so I guess that was almost a starting point in some ways. We sort of wondered whether actually for people who are atheists, and that is an increasing number in the UK, is that part of the problem? Are we having a sort of secular crisis, the fact that this path and what happens afterwards isn't already mapped out for us? So we do touch on that a bit, but that's because the subject matter is so broad, we have been quite particular about it, looking at what we want to focus on and how it relates to us, because of course we can't touch on everything, sadly. That's another show to look at.
And it would be fascinating to look at, you know, the myriad of different cultural perspectives that there are on death. But as Antonia said, we did have to kind of narrow that down, and we really thought about our own experience in relation to it, which hopefully I think other people can probably see their relationship with death within the show. We were very aware of that although it's autobiographical or semi-autobiographical, that actually there's so much to draw on that feels universal, and that's what's so fascinating about death, is it does come for us all. So the material feels very relevant to everybody, and yeah, maybe show two is different cultural perspectives perhaps.
As you said that, I could almost feel the scythe then passing past me, but anyway, we won't delve into that. Now, interestingly, what you said there, do you think it's a British problem? Do you think that the British, they're probably not alone in having an issue around death and talking about death? There's been a lot recently about this idea of Swedish death cleaning. Have you come across this?
Yes,
which,
yeah.
For the listener, I should explain, isn't perhaps as sinister as it sounds. It's more about folks towards the end of their life preparing for the end of their life and decluttering and making sure that their legacy and their heritage is passed on if it's physical objects. So, but is it uniquely British that we, you know, it's another thing we don't like to talk about?
Well, I think, I mean, the research that we have done into other cultures, it does feel that in Britain we are particularly reserved around death. We've had a lot of different conversations about why that is with a lot of different people, and, you know, people hark back to Victorians who were very grand and were very creative and quite performative in how... in how they manage death and the rituals around death. But people have said that from sort of First World War, that's when it all sort of was stripped back, and it became a much more difficult subject for people to talk about. I mean, presumably that's because it was so apparent that death was people were dying all the time during the First World War. But then perhaps that's a legacy of that we've become fixed in a certain way of doing things. But from what we've experienced, we've met so many people who are trying to do things differently and trying to offer people options, choice, make it personal, make it creative, to show people that there are other options out there.
There are things that are uniquely British about it in terms of, it's a generalisation, but, you know, in terms of our cultural preference to not talk about things that are too personal and not be too emotive. But I think these problems are probably maybe common across all cultures, but particularly those that are people who are secular. I think it's and that's going to extend to a lot of other countries as well, and a lot of other different people, because it's, if you don't believe in an afterlife and this is it, then fundamentally we're not talking about a fear of death, we're talking about not living a life, a good life, we're not living a life fully, which is what the show deals with. And every time you talk about death, that might sound morbid, which just means about death, so yes, it is morbid, but actually what you're talking about is life and quality of life and a life well lived, and that's what the show deals with a lot as well, and that's what a lot of our conversations have been about. Mm. You can't talk about death without talking about life and finding meaning within that.
Now, I think there are some really intriguing ideas and questions in what you're doing, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about was how you translate some of those things into a performance, into the stage. Because earlier on, when I was coming to find you in the back of the theatre, there was a mop covered in glitter, and there was all kinds of, you know, lots of very technical showbiz things. So I just wonder, I always wonder how you take very, perhaps, complicated ideas, intricate ideas, and how you translate that on stage, but also how you make it funny again. You know, how's it physically done?
Oh, the magic of theatre.
Yeah.
That's what the glitter is, I guess, isn't it, the magic? Yeah.
I mean, we were very keen from actually the moment we started that we didn't want this to be an hour of misery. We wanted it to be human. We wanted life to be very prevalent in the show, and I guess to maybe show a different way of talking about death, a different approach, a different side of it.
I mean, to give like a very specific example, I suppose, because it's hard to summarise like the amount of conversations we've had and the sort of journey that you take through that. But we went to go and meet some people at a palliative care unit who were dying, and we imagined it to be difficult because we were talking about death, but actually what we really found difficult was how to connect with people who are maybe not in a place where they wanted to talk about death. And that's to do with our naivety as well, of how we approach that situation and the fact that people were in such a different place than we were, particularly as for most of them we were significantly younger as well. And from that we talked about the awkwardness of that, we talked about our expectations and the reality, and that translated really quickly actually into two scenes where we show this magical version of the conversations we hoped to happen, where we would meet a wise woman who would give us this gift of knowledge, and then we contrast that with the reality, which is me trying to give Antonia a couple of custard creams and her not being very impressed and me leaving embarrassed. So that's a very clear example of real that just translated quite naturally into theatre.
Now let's talk about the canvas, as it were, in terms of where you're performing. Mainly I think you're performing in theatres and doing sort of studio performances, if you like. There is a cemetery performance, which is in Arnest Vale Cemetery in Bristol.
That's right. Yes. So that's actually the final date of our of this preview tour. Yes, we're really pleased. We're going to be part of a life and death festival that the cemetery are running that weekend, and it's actually called Life, Death and the Rest, and our show is the finale. And it's a festival the cemetery have been running for a couple of years now as a way of engaging with people around the subject of death and dying, which is actually feels very sort of forward thinking for a cemetery actually. I don't know if many people know Arnest Vale, but it's a beautiful, beautiful site, old Victorian garden cemetery. And I know they have during their festival they have all sorts of different activities, mainly creative ones actually, inviting people to come and have these conversations in lots of different ways. So we're going to be performing in one of their chapels, which is going to be very interesting. And I mean, it will be fantastic to see actually how our show sits within that environment, with death being very present around us. Yeah.
I mean, it's a perfect platform for the subject, but also I mean, it's quite a challenge, isn't it? Really, in terms of taking it somewhere as direct, if you like, as that, I think. Do you think it's provocative doing that, or...?
I think within the context of a festival, probably not.
Okay.
I think it's within a frame that feels like that holds it quite securely, and actually, outside of that context, yes, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
But it would be really interesting. I mean, what would happen if the show was in a pub, or if the show was in a library? It'd be really interesting to explore that further, actually, about taking theatre out of theatres is always quite exciting as well, and what happens when you remove that frame of it being a theatre show as such, and start to actually kind of share it as what it kind of is as well, which is a presentation of our experiences, and hopefully a really fun hour of entertainment.
So you're touring, I guess, in, well, I don't guess, I know you're touring in Leeds and London and Bristol and here in Birmingham. So what? Where does it go next? Where does the show go next? Have you got ideas about other things you might translate it into? I mean, you know, radio, for example, it would work quite well on radio. Television, you know, those kind of things.
Lots of plans for world domination. But, yeah, you know, obviously we can't possibly tell you those.
So just finally, what kind of reaction has the show had, or the sort of the idea of the show? Do people sort of find it, have they found it, if they're anxious about it, has it helped? Do you know? What kind of feedback have you had?
Well, we've been very fortunate though. It's been very positive so far. I think people have really been fascinated with a lot of the research that we're presenting. Last year when we previewed the show, we had a number of sort of post-show talks, and people really wanted to know more about our experiences. They wanted to know what happened at the crematorium, tell us in detail about what happened. So, and that sort of almost feels like it reinforces what we're doing, that people really do want to know about these things. And when you create a space in order for people to ask those questions and to have that conversation, then positive and good things happen. So far it's been positive, but we will see how it goes.
I mean, we're well aware that with a title like the Breath Death Show, there might be people who come specifically because they're grieving. That's going to be really interesting. We haven't really explored what happens if that's the case, but we're well aware that we may have set up a space for that to occur. And how the show is received, if people are in a grieving place or they're looking for something that's maybe a bit more solemn, will be really interesting because it isn't those things. I'm well aware as well, people may avoid it as well because of the title. Mm. It's going to be a really interesting experiment, actually, who it brings and who is put off by it and what that means, really.
Well, I shall be along later on for the performance. My mind will be wide open. And for the meantime, Antonia and Lucy, thank you for asking a big question and letting me ask some smaller questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can find out more on the show and its background by going to www.thedeathshow.co.uk or Facebook at The Death Show BHAM. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Now we consider over 2,000 years of history in less than 20 minutes. Black Men Walking is a brave, authentic performance piece crafted by the Eclipse Theatre Company and directed by Dawn Walton. Through the wonders of modern technology, or a scratchy phone line at least, I caught up with cast member Tondere Munyevu to get a lowdown on this story of friendship, identity and belonging during its run at Coventry's Belgrade Theatre.
Okay, so joining me on the line now is Tondere Munyevu, who is currently performing as part of Black Men Walking at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry. Tondere, you've just, I think, come out of a performance. You've just come off stage. So we're very grateful for your time.
Thank you.
And
that's great.
Let's start with Black Men Walking first of all, and let's start to sort of try and give folks a bit of an outline of what it's about. When you read, I think, the synopsis on the website, it kind of sounds like something here that's probably the longest running sitcom, which is Last of the Summer Wine, but it's I think it's quite different from that.
Well, actually, there is a reference to Last of the Summer Wine. And I suppose it is in that way. But this one is a slightly different one because it does have to deal with a whole different set of circumstances. It is black men walking. They're walking the countryside, and it's three of them on a particularly difficult day in terms of the weather. And one thing leads to another. But, you know, it's really an exploration of who these people are and who they see themselves as versus what society sees them as. Because they're just normal people, you know, but they happen to be black men. And what happens if these black men walk the countryside? Something happens for them. The process of walking the countryside for them is, you know, for health and for creating a safe space with between the gentlemen who are on the walk. Actually, women are allowed to go to the walk as well, because this is based on a real black man's walking group, which is based in Sheffield. So in this space, they, you know, they get to learn about themselves, they get to have a clear discussion. But on this particular day, something else happens, which is to do with the past, meeting the present, meeting the future.
So there's something here, I think, about sort of travelling through, I guess travelling through time in one sense, but also sort of through identity and through history. Is that how it's framed?
Yes, it is. Well, it's very complicated, so I'll try and make it quite simple. I mean, by complicated, I don't mean difficult. I mean,
no.
It's just it's got so many different aspects to it. Basically, black British people, of course, we know have been in... black people have been in England for a very long time, but it's not a story that we get to hear about that much. But through these characters and through this particular walk on this particular day, we're able to really... see quite a breadth of what the black history in England has been, what the history for black people has been, how many people have been here over the years. So it is exploring the heritage that's almost hidden, if not deliberately hidden, from the rest of the world. What happens in this particular part of the world is that these gentlemen are able to see their history in some way and to bring it up. And then they're also able to really project themselves into a future that's a bit more sort of positive, I would say.
Now, there's something as well about the journey in the piece, in the play, about, I suppose in some way, the kind of three main protagonists, I'll try and get that word out properly, getting kind of stuck or stranded, you know, forced to kind of reflect and forced to kind of consider who and where they are. And I think that's quite, in some ways, that's quite a clever marker, because there's it's by no coincidence, I think, that this performance and this piece comes at a time of the kind of anniversary of the Windrush, you know, the kind of inward migration of folks from the Caribbean and from afar into the UK. There's a really nice parallel, I think, there.
Yes, there is. Although I have to say that the director, John Walton, who was really the first person to get this play going, she was invited to the Black Men's Walking Group in Sheffield, which is an actual thing that happens, and she went along. And then she was fascinated, actually, by being on that walk and being able to see signs that black people have been on the English soil, what we now call the English soil, for centuries. And so when we talk about Windrush, we tend to kind of sort of cut off black history up to that point, as to say black people arrived on Windrush. But there is a whole lot more before that, where we've had some iconic, fantastic black people, Septimus Severus, an African leader, was here. There was a trumpet player at Henry VIII's court. I mean, all sorts of fantastic, interesting ideas of things, real things that happened, real people who were here, who walked this earth, who walked this land, the English land, which we now call the English land, before Windrush, way, way, way before Windrush. So I think it's to do with the deeper, broader sense of black history in Britain.
And I think the Peak District and the kind of the Yorkshire surrounds, as it were, help in some ways, don't they, to sort of bring out that identity.
Absolutely. Well, we were very lucky, my colleagues and I, to be able to join the group, the walking group, for one afternoon, and to be able to see how beautiful that district is, and also how, in a way, it has been preserved. You know, so when you're walking and you're seeing millstones and you're seeing all these sort of almost ancient trackways, as we like to call them in the play, you're able to imagine what other black people historically who were there and what their experiences of what we now call Britain would be, or English land, you know. So it's the perfect setting, I think, to really sort of embrace the mysticism of trying to excavate your ancestral heritage where it is hidden in a way in the rest of the country.
And I bet when you went out and about to do that kind of research, I bet you it was cold and wet.
You know, I was very, very cold. I actually felt my toes just go numb, and I didn't recover for quite some time. But you know, I was very, very lucky to meet all these gentlemen who had such diverse opinions about the world, but who were really, really, really excited that something that they'd started themselves, which was obviously open to all black people and women and whoever else wanted to come, that this was being celebrated in this way. And I tell you, these are just fascinating, brilliant people who are just also ordinary men and women who live in England, who don't live in London, who don't live in all these major cities that we like to think of as being urban spaces where black people live. These were just normal people with normal jobs who are black men who happen to be walking because they enjoy it. And it is a safe space for them. And I think that's the greatest message of the play, that, you know, often as black people, we have to assume an identity that's based on us, which may not be accurate about us. And so to be able to be in a safe space in the countryside and also learning something about your own history that has... quite frankly, been hidden away from you. It's a fascinating, profound experience.
Let's talk a little bit about your character as well in the play. So you play Richard, who I think is the youngest of the three kind of walkers that are featured.
Yeah, I keep stressing that out. No offense to my fantastic colleagues, but I still got some more life in me. I want to put it out there.
Now, is he, from what I've read, is he a bit of a geek? Is that how I describe him? Because he's a computer programmer. He likes Star Trek. Yeah. These are classic kind of geek characteristics.
Yes, I'm just missing the spectacles. But, other than that, I think you're quite accurate. He is a very profound person, because often when we think of people who are Trekkies and who are so intellectual, we don't think of them as having a kind of power, a kind of inner reserve. And he definitely does have one. And what I love about him is that the issues that he's dealing with within the play are not to do with the typical things that we assume African men to be dealing with. And he is a fascinating person, actually quite blunt, quite funny. I've really had a great time playing him. And he really bounces off the rest of the characters in the play. I'm trying not to mention some of the things in the play, because there ought to be a surprise in it. But he is a great counterbalance to the other two gentlemen.
Let's talk finally about the kind of series of things, I guess, that are happening across 2018. So this is, I think, one of the first of sort of several works. Part of it came out of something, I think, which is called Rev Mixed or Revolution Mix. So it's a kind of new writing scheme, I think.
Well, I don't know if I can do it justice, but I think the idea with Revolution Mix, which is Dawn Walton and her company Eclipse, they wanted to be able to produce a large amount of black work around the same time that will be going out into audiences around the same time. So there's sort of an explosion of black work and an explosion of black artists working in different ways, so that, you know, you don't have one production and then you wait a year or two and then get another production and then wait, you know, which often happens with black work in this country. I think the idea was just to try and get a sort of mix of different things happening, a kind of movement happening, really. And so we are the flagship. We've come out first, and I'm very pleased that we have, because I think we've done a great job. So if it gets bad from here, it's not our fault. So yeah, but I think it'll be exciting. I've seen a couple other things that the Revolution Mix encompasses, and it's all just fascinating, multi-dimensional, absolutely fascinating. Everyone's going to want to see it. It's not just for black audiences. I think Dawn keeps mentioning the fact that, you know, theatre should have a diverse, mixed audience. There should be a dialogue in the process of watching a show. There should be a dialogue in the foyer afterwards, on social media. And then in terms of legacy, we should be able, all of us, to experience the same thing. I'm an African actor who loves working as playing African characters, but also British characters or American characters. But I also love watching Downton Abbey and any other sort of period English thing. It's not mutually exclusive. We can actually enjoy each other's culture. And the more specific that we are in the story that we're telling, the more enjoyable any audience will find that story. So I'm excited that this is happening and that, you know, I've been a part of it very early on.
I think what's great is, and how it's described, is it's black-led. And I think what's really important about that, particularly in theatre, is it isn't just one thing as part of a programme that's compiled because people feel it should be there. It is very authentic. It's very, you know, sort of personal, and, you know, it's not exclusive.
Well, and also, black-led doesn't mean it's just for black people. It is part of a broader dialogue that we need to have in this country. about art and who it belongs to, and it belongs to everyone, you know. And it's been very fascinating watching this play, because absolutely everyone is relating to it in their own way. You know, we've had people who are not black who happen to be walkers, and they've just said, gosh, you know, you've just really taken me back to some of my favorite walks, or to a particular walk that was very difficult, that had a tricky ending, or where I had to be lifted out of there, or whatever. So it has a lot in it that appeals to a lot of people. The poetry in it is absolutely sumptuous. It has got great movement, great songs, which Testament has also written. So, you know, it's a great experience to come out and enjoy it.
Well, listen, Tundra, I wish you every success with this project and other
Jeff.
Projects.
I hope I made sense, because my brain is a bit all over the place.
Clear as a bell, as they say. It's been a real pleasure to catch up with you. Thanks so much for your time.
And finally, in this last part of the show, we cast light on jazz as a genre and a freedom of expression through a dressing room catch-up with Paul Dunmull and John O'Gallagher as they played an intimate set at Mac Birmingham. True to form, I started with another big question.
Now let's start with jazz, okay? Because a lot of our listeners probably have an idea of what jazz is, but it's actually not as easy to define as people think it is. So what... How would you start? I like the hard questions first. I should have said that earlier.
Yeah, that's the hardest question. I mean, you know, I think that people use the word jazz in a way to describe what their idea of jazz is, because it's really everyone has their own interpretation of what it means and you know, the things that have been attached to it. I mean, so for myself, I know when I say jazz, if I use the term jazz, which I don't really like, but I find myself needing to use it sometimes, that what it means is a tradition where the music what its source, all the people that have played the music that has influenced me come from. And that doesn't mean just that it has to swing, you know, and it doesn't mean 1950, and it doesn't mean a specific era. It means basically... you know, compendium of music that has influenced me, improvised-based, African-American, you know, roots, you know, rooted movement.
And that's an interesting word, mood, isn't it, Paul? So what do you think the mood of jazz is at present?
I don't know what it is at present, but what it sums up for me is freedom, to be able to... The attraction of jazz music to me was freedom, being able to play, especially as a horn player, you're not playing in a horn section, or whatever, in these bands where you didn't get much space to be yourself. There's pleasure in that, but I was always attracted to the idea of being able to really have a good play, express myself in whatever way, you know. So it was, for me, freedom is the big word. And I know what John means about jazz. A lot of the greats didn't like the word jazz.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
You know, I think it goes back to, you know, probably CD days, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's a label, but my label is called it freedom music then. How about that?
I like that.
But that won't last.
Yeah.
Now you're both, I think, saxophonists by trade.
That's right.
Be careful how I say that. So how did you come to the saxophone? Is it an instrument people naturally pick up, or have you sort of progressed through other things, or how did you come to it? Was it just there, or was it...
You know, individuals get attracted. Why would they pick up the drums? Why would they go... Something happens. I mean, I started on clarinet.
Okay.
I mean, I won't even bore you with the start of that. And my father was a drummer, so I heard jazz music in the house. But I was more into Hendrix, you know. I wasn't really, you know... But I was playing clarinet, classical clarinet, listening to Hendrix. And then one day I was on my bike, 14 years old, and I saw a saxophone in the window. And I thought, yeah, I fancy that.
So there was a moment,
I've had a few moments, and that was one of them. And that was one. I thought, right, I want one of them, and I got it, and it was great to play, and it went from there. So.
And you also dabble in something that's called a saxello. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that's just it's a bent. To get technical, it's a bent soprano saxophone. It's a make that was made in 1926 by King, so it was just a different shape.
It looks like a kind of regal banana, doesn't it?
It's something like that, yeah. All sax fans look like bent bananas in a way, but, you know, the sax cello has got a right-angled bell, which is unusual, very unusual, in fact. So it's a very nearly 100 years old, that.
So let's talk about the two of you as well together, because it's quite an interesting pairing, really, because you're not... I wouldn't say you were sort of natural neighbours initially. So, John, you're from California, I think.
Well, originally, I was born in Anaheim. I left there when I was about 7 years old. So I think that, you know, I spent half my childhood in Spokane, Washington, near where my father's family was from, in Montana. And then when I was about 20 years old, I moved to Boston to go to school. And then I haven't lived there since. So.
And Paul, you're from what we call the Garden of England. Kent,
That's right. Kent, yes, that's right. Yeah.
But you're not.
It wasn't really the Garden of Eden, though.
No.
Because it was 10 miles from the centre of London, so I was right on the edge.
Ah.
Welling, a place called Welling, which is definitely not. But you could get into the countryside from where I live. But it was a suburb of London. All the East Londoners used to move there when they got out the East End.
Yeah.
They used to come down to Welling, so. It was a bit hairy, actually, Welling, in my youth, and so I was quite happy to leave. But I'm in the Garden of Eden now, because Worcestershire is beautiful.
Yeah.
And I've been there for 30 years, and it's fantastic.
Ah, he's gone native.
I've turned native.
So you've both, I think I'm right in saying that you came together in April of last year, with a kind of surge in spring kind of festival or the event. So how were you introduced? Did you sort of know each other before, or did you sort of just sort of stumble in on each other's gig? How did it work?
I'd known Paul's music for a long time, and actually I think Paul had been playing with friends of mine from New York before, like Tony Malaby. So I've known, been a bit of a fan of Paul's for a long time. When Tony Dudley Evans, you know, kind of facilitated the Surge in Spring concert, really excited to do it. You know, it was so much fun. It was a fantastic concert. You know, so I'm really grateful to Tony for setting this next tour up that we're going to be doing starting tonight.
Because it works so well.
Yeah.
I mean, he's unbelievable. Oh. I mean, frightening. So I was playing away. Hello, excuse me. So this.
You mean he's practiced? Yeah, it's not fair. Yeah, is it?
I thought, now he's got this new job, he won't practice so much, but. Now he's just come back from New York, so he's tired. This may be my chance.
I told you. I said, yeah, you have to take it easy on him.
Yeah, no, I can't let him off. I've got to get him tonight.
So about that, you've been at the Grammys, I think, rather exciting.
Yeah, I have a dear friend of mine, Alan Ferber, who's a fantastic trombone player, great composer, great improviser. I've been playing for many years. A big band that he runs in New York. We've done a couple records, and about 3 years ago we did a record that was nominated for a Grammy, and then this year it happened again. So I was very, you know, excited and grateful to Alan for inviting me to go. A bunch of us who were in the band, we attended with him, and it was great fun. I mean, you know, it's a bizarro world. It's not anything like you ever experience in life. It's like kind of surreal. It was really fun getting to do it with all my buddies. And you know, the other jazz bands that were there are all friends from New York. So I got to hang at the parties and visit with them. And it was wonderful. I'm very grateful.
Tell you enjoyed it just by how you've described it, which is
interesting. Very fun.
So let's just talk about collaboration if we can, because I think jazz, not all of jazz, but jazz is a style of music where improvisation is really important. It's an important element of it. And it links back to, Paul, what you were saying about freedom. You know, it's kind of flexibility, fluidity almost. So what I'm interested in, what sort of constraints kind of creep in when you play as a duo, or, you know, in a quartet? Is it more liberating, or does it place sort of barriers around what you're doing?
Well, I suppose the more people you have, the difficult it becomes if you're going to improvise.
Mm.
But the crux of the matter is jazz is about improvising. The main core of it is to improvise. You will have heads maybe, or, you know, tunes that they work on. But the main goal is to get to the improvising, and that's the freedom part of it. And when you play with other people, you know, there are constraints, but obviously the smaller, you know, a quartet is a beautiful group because it doesn't always work. Sometimes you're improvising and it's not all great. Sometimes it's not happening for no apparent reason. But when you've got the better musicians that you play with, someone will make it happen. And so it's like, I mean, no disrespect to students, but if you've got four students just improvising, it can be hard work. They don't know. But when you've got four experienced players, although it sometimes may not be happening, someone in a split second will do something to move it. And that is the joy for me. That is the total joy of playing this music, improvised music, when it's hard and all of a sudden someone does something, and it's so intense and so much concentration is required. You can't, you have to have 100% concentration listening, and you become super sensitive actually to this stuff. And whatever another player plays can inspire you, and then you hopefully inspire them. And the end result is something hopefully magical, you know.
That's interesting. So there's
I'm sure it'll happen tonight.
A dynamic that kind of emerges as you kind of progress through it.
Well, yes. I mean, actually, we're going to do improvised music tonight, which for me, why I love that music is often a time swinging thing, a dynamic that's normally at sort of there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Improvised music can be like a pin drop, absolutely full on, and it can noise in a matter of 10 seconds, you know. And so I love the dynamic of that music. Yeah.
Anyway. And John, how about you? What sort of things does playing in a duo or quartet kind of bring to your playing?
Playing improvised music with musicians of this caliber, it's a transcendent kind of experience that you have, because you lose your sense of self and you become part of this bigger kind of force that has almost a life of its own. And I find, like, you know, probably the most fun that you can have alive, you know, really. I mean, honestly, it is. It's the most fun you can have. And the great thing about it, too, is that, you know, you learn about yourself as you're doing this, because you realize that, you know, at certain points, you know, in the music, you know, like anything in life, you know, there are moments that absolutely are unexplainable, that are transcendent. And then there are other moments where, you know, you might be in a holding pattern, and there's things like, okay, there's a decision that has to be made. Is it going to go right? Is it going to go left? Are we going to, you know, how is this going to, what's going to happen next? And it's that anticipation of what's going to happen. You can feel it coming, but then when it happens, it's completely a surprise. And those kinds of experiences, like, you know, I learn about myself through the music in terms of, you know, limits that I might place on myself or preconceptions about the ways of doing things or the way what something could be. You know, you really, it's like looking in a mirror, and you really start to understand your own, you're only limited by your imagination.
Before we finish, I wanted to ask you about another John. Okay, so John Coltrane, I think, is a bit of a key figure for both of you. Just tell me something about his influence in terms of what you're doing tonight, but also what you have been doing, you know, over your sort of your time as musicians.
I can remember the first time I heard Coltrane, I didn't like him, and it was when I was very young. I was 17, and it was with the Miles Davis Sextet, and I was a big Cannonball fan, and consequently, you know, like maybe 2 or 3 years later, when I started actually really studying, you know, jazz and music of that era, then I you know, was blown over by a recording that he did with Gene Ammons called Groove Blues, and there's where he's playing alto, because I've always been an alto player, never a tenor player, and I heard him play this solo on Gene Ammons' record on alto from 1960, I think it was recorded, and I transcribed it, and I was blown away, and ever since then, Coltrane has been one of my biggest influences, and so, you know, his music is, you know, I mean, I don't think it would be an overstatement to say that his music's changed my life, you know. And so, you know, right now, I mean, the reason I came to the UK is I had been doing research on two of his recordings, and then I began doing a PhD here on that, and so that's what's led me to where we are now. But yeah, towering figure of jazz.
You can't really state how powerful his influence has been on the whole world of jazz, on every musician. Everybody knows him. I mean, it's very difficult. We've been asked this question hundreds of times, probably. You could spend an hour talking about this. I just love the man, and I just thank him for what he did for all of us. He brought spirituality to the fore, really, of jazz music. And that power, I mean, you can hear his playing and his lines and his sound, everything. He ticks all the box, 10 out of 10. Then there's this other factor of his spirit, or what the hell it is, who knows. It's something incredibly powerful, which I think most people pick up on, you know, and then it affects musicians that, and they think, I want that. What is that? How do I get that? And you try and find a way of doing that. But I mean, he's like a Bach. He's like a Mozart. He will go down in hundreds of years' time and still be revered. I personally don't think you're going to hear anyone ever better than that. You'll hear in that style. There will be other guys come along and do very interesting things, but there's never been a better Bach, you know. It's like, right. That's it. Bach is Bach. Coltrane is Coltrane. And Bach had loads of disciples, and that's what Coltrane's done. There's loads of us have looked to him and used him as our father figure to help us with our music, you know.
Tough act to follow.
Impossible. Not tough, impossible.
We set the bar quite high there. So let's just finish on talking about your tour. So you're playing the Mac here in Birmingham tonight. Tomorrow night you're off to the Bristol Fringe, I think. Is that right? So heading kind of to the coast. There's definitely coast in Bristol, so you might get a bit of sea air.
Yeah, there's the Severn Estuary.
Yeah, if you're lucky, you might get a whiff of that. And you're also, I think, doing the Vortex Club in London as well. Yeah, so. Yeah. That's great, isn't it? You've got a kind of, a flurry of sort of wild nights. Is that how you're looking at it? Or is you kind of thinking, oh, I can't wait till we get to Friday or something?
It's great that we're doing night to night because, you know, in, with musicians, you know, like these guys and doing improvised music, there's no telling what's going to be happening when we get to the end of the tour. It's going to be madness. It's going to be insane. Oh, I can't wait. Yeah.
There's lots of enthusiasm. It's been really great to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time. I'm going to be sticking around for the gig as well later on, so I'll be looking out for that magic dynamic of freedom that you described.
Well,
so no pressure.
No pressure. So, we will be looking for it as well. No guarantees, but we're going to be trying.
For the meantime, Paul, John, thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Now, if you found that as mind-blowing as I did, you can check out similar treats at www.thsh.co.uk/jazzlines for future performances and events. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Outer Circles Arts, Eclipse Theatre, Mac Birmingham, TDE Promotions, the Belgrade Theatre Coventry, and a special thanks to Marcia Springer. The new Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.